Thanks. So I don't have too many slides here. The idea I'm going to present for my own work is simple enough that I think I can present it pretty quickly. I also am hoping to spark a little bit of thought and discussion about other constraints that I think have not been sufficiently appreciated. So it says primordial black holes. I'll basically be talking about constraints on things that are, call it planet mass and up. So I won't be talking about that asteroid mass window. If you have in your mind the primordial black hole picture, then the very low mass things, presumably excluded because they would have evaporated due to Hawking radiation, the very high mass things will wreak dynamical havoc on galaxies, as I will show here. And in the middle, there are constraints from microlensing of individual stars in nearby galaxies, the large and small Magellanic clouds. If the halo were chock full of these black holes, then you would see microlensing brightenings of all of these stars as black holes pass in front of them. And so there are, in a sense, two windows where primordial black holes could still make up the bulk of the dark matter. One of them around 1 to 100 solar masses, and the other from where Hawking radiation stops being a constraint up to where microlensing starts being a constraint, call it the asteroid mass window. So in this talk, I'll be discussing why I think the stellar mass window is largely closed despite the excitement over LIGO. So LIGO saw a black hole merger. That suggests that there are lots of these black holes out there, and the stellar evolution theorists, I think it's not obvious how you get 20 or 30 solar mass black holes, how you form them in a configuration where they can merge. So it sparked some excitement about this mass window, but I think there are astrophysical reasons to believe that it's probably not the bulk of the dark matter. So I imagine I don't need to convince this group that dark matter is a thing. This is just one of many possible examples. You can pick your favorite one, whether it's the bullet cluster and the separation of the matter from lensing and the X-rays tracing the hot gas, whether you prefer the CMB power spectrum as your definitive evidence of dark matter, whether you just think all of it together is pretty conclusive. I think the case is fairly closed that there's something that acts an awful lot like dark matter, and then the question becomes, what is it? So for a long time, people have looked at WIMPs, and here at the university, there are several people working on some of these experiments trying to detect WIMPs by the weak interactions of a massive particle with some experiment deep underground where they have their backgrounds under control. So far, of course, they have found nothing. And then I know that some people here have thought about other forms of dark matter, for example, axions, which could have other observable effects. On the very low mass end, an axion-like particle could be kind of fuzzy. It could have a de Broglie wavelength that is relevant on astrophysical scales, and therefore could suppress small-scale power. Axions could also convert back and forth between photons under the right conditions, and so those may have observable effects. And there are many experiments trying to constrain some of those. So in this case, I'll be talking about another scenario that's been discussed for a long time, primordial black holes, which have the benefit of actually, well, black holes exist anyway, we're pretty sure about that, so that's good. And another really good thing about this is that it does make testable predictions, as I will discuss. If the bulk matter of the dark matter is in primordial black holes, then these things, in important ways, will behave differently from dark matter that is a particle, but is much, much lower mass than stars or anything else. So the key fact here, in this scenario, if black holes have masses comparable to or larger than stars, then they will participate in the things that stars do in a different way than if they were very low mass. Things like lensing where now the dark matter is inherently lumpy and not smooth, and things like dynamics, where now the black holes are as massive or more massive than the stars, and the flow of energy, if they are initially equal temperature, can change some. There are other constraints that people have looked at for a while, CMB distortions. I won't really talk about this one, although Yassin Ali-Hamoud had a nice paper a couple of years ago updating those constraints, suggesting that they are problematic for primordial black holes, but not definitive. I think that's probably going to be the conclusion for all of these, that they are problematic to various degrees. If you really, really want, maybe there's a way to squeeze your way under there and evade some of these constraints, but it's really hard to the point that I've grown extremely pessimistic about the primordial black hole scenario, at least in this mass window. In this talk, I'll discuss mostly dynamical heating, which is something that I worked on a couple of years ago.
Tim, you're going to show constraints for all of those, or no?
I'm going to show constraints from this, this, and this, yes. So black hole mergers, I wouldn't really say that's a constraint in the sense that Simeon Bird suggested that the rates that you might expect from primordial black hole mergers are consistent with the LIGO rates. I'm not going to discuss that, but I will show some of these constraints, and you can decide for yourselves how problematic you think they are for this scenario. The microlensing ones are a little bit fuzzier. Those are also the ones that I understand the least. So I'll do my best to explain where those come from and why those exist, how secure they are. Because I think this one has also been the least appreciated by the community. Certainly, if you go by citations, this has been largely ignored. And I am not quite sure why.
Because very few people in the community actually understand microlensing, I think.
That is probably the case.
It's a weird bunch, those microlensing.
It is. Paul Schechter has a couple of very influential papers from 10 to 20 years ago on this, so I shamelessly stole some of his figures and put them in here. But the only paper really explicitly applying this to the case of dark matter, as far as I know, is a paper from a couple years ago. And it hasn't gotten very much attention. I don't know why. Anyway, the basic idea for dynamical heating is extremely simple. So if you have a collection of particles and they can collide with one another through some force or another, for a gas it would be electromagnetic forces, for stars it would be gravitational forces. You'll get to a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution if you just hold them in a box. And the characteristic energy will be the same regardless of the mass, but the characteristic speed will not. And so if you have gas in a box, then your more massive atoms or molecules will be moving slower. And it's no different with stars. So if you could somehow keep stars in a box and they had relaxed to some Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, then they would show exactly the same behavior. So this is the idea that that's the stable end state for a stellar system in a box. Real stellar systems don't exist in a box. They exist in some kind of a halo or some kind of a cluster or something. But the idea is similar. At a fixed position in this halo or in this cluster, you'll move toward equipartition, you'll move toward constant energy regardless of the mass of the particle. So, if you have something more massive, it will tend to give energy to the less massive things. So if you imagine WIMP dark matter that's less massive than stars, the energy will flow in one direction until you reach some equipartition like this, some steady state. If the dark matter is more massive than the stars, you'll flow the other way. Okay? Since we are in some kind of a halo or some kind of a cluster, then adding additional energy to one component will tend to make its distribution puffier. So if you have some constant density background, some constant velocity dispersion of dark matter, then if the dark matter is less massive than the stars will dynamically cool. The cluster will contract. If the dark matter is more massive than the stars will dynamically heat. You can think of the dark matter as being a thermal bath, because in these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies, there is essentially no stellar matter relative to the dark matter. Not quite true, but the mass distribution is totally dominated by dark matter. And so these ultra-faint dwarfs are the ideal laboratory to study these kinds of effects. Here's one of them. I think you can see it pretty clearly given that all the stars in the galaxy are circled in green. But if it were not for the circles in green, I certainly wouldn't be able to pick that out. So these ultra-faint dwarf galaxies are things that we've only been able to find recently because they are so poor in stars. We think these things are real because these stars all look to be at the same distance. They all have the same, to the extent that we can measure such a thing, velocity on the sky, and they all have the same, essentially, radial velocity. So this population of stars looks like it's more or less the same age and it's moving together. It looks like it is bound to a halo of dark matter. So we can estimate how much dark matter there is in this case, and it is a whole lot more than the mass in stars. If these stars are being dynamically heated by dark matter, then the dark matter distribution, as far as we can tell, seems to extend to very large distances, and that's what cold dark matter simulations suggest it should do. It should extend much, much larger than the couple tens of parsecs over which the stars extend. And if you have a smooth distribution of dark matter, then over time the stars should just puff up. Yes?
So as someone who is primarily an analytic work person and not a computation person,
yes.
I think something I've always kind of wondered about these kinds of conclusions is, you know, what level of confidence do I give that we captured the physics?
It is, so the physics here is two-body relaxation. We have two bodies, they pass by one another, you approximate the strength of the interaction. It is dominated by weak interactions, not by the strong scatterings, but by the weak ones. And then it becomes a diffusion problem. So these classical approximations are pretty simple, and they have been verified by Fokker-Planck calculations. I think they're not perfect, but certainly within a factor of a few, I think they're good.
Can I ask?
Yes.
So I'm trying to grow some intuition here. So
yes.
So basically the underlying process is like two-body, must not even be two-body scattering. You say
it is two-body, yes.
Okay, but gravity is not green, so in principle you can scatter them.
Right.
But I just wonder in terms of, so if you think in terms of energy transfer,
yes.
You're most efficient if two particles have the same mass, right? Here you just have a linear scaling with mass. So you always assume, why is that? So why is there no suppression factor if I take the natural mass very large that I sort of start suppressing the energy transfer in the system?
If you have in the limit of a very large, so this is looking at the diffusion of energy from one particle to another. If you have equal masses, then sure, you'll efficiently exchange energy between them, but there will be no net diffusion from one population to another because they're all the same. So the net diffusion just scales with the mass. The net diffusion also scales inversely with the velocity dispersion. The higher speed these collisions are, you should just make the impact approximation, for example, then if these collisions occur slowly, you get more of a kick than if they occur very fast. And so that's another reason why these tiny little galaxies that have been discovered recently are so powerful. Because in our Milky Way, the characteristic sigma for these interactions, at least in the galactic center, is hundreds of kilometers per second. In the case of these dwarf galaxies, it's 10 or tens of times smaller. But where these come from, this is just straight out of classical galactic dynamics. So this is basically a textbook problem in energy transfer between two different populations. Okay. So this injection of energy. Yes. Yeah.
One more. I guess. So I saw a talk a few weeks ago where someone mentioned that when you have these dark matter in the simulations, when you add some kind of baryon effect, like a disk potential into it,
yes,
your subhalo mass function changes.
So you have a dark matter only simulation.
So if you.
And the, yeah.
So the difference between dark matter only.
Yes.
Versus dark matter plus baryon.
Yes.
The baryons are actually going to break up some of your subhalos and lead to potentially like a different dwarf distribution, for example.
You mean feedback from baryons and star formation and all of that sort of thing?
So this wasn't very clearly, because it was kind of a side note in the talk.
Okay.
But I guess I'm sort of along those lines, is that also something that is going to be dependent on whether we're talking about machos or some other kind of wimpy model?
So I wouldn't think so. Dynamical heating in this case happens slowly. On the time scales of forming stars, I wouldn't expect it to be relevant on the time scale of a gas collapse. This is something that manifests over a long time. It would expand the cluster over a time scale of gigayears. So I wouldn't expect that to have any impact. Although, as a side note to this, those simulations where they have dark matter particles, you can't have a simulation with actual WIMPs. You need to have placeholders for WIMPs that are actually 1,000 solar masses or something. And if you make your placeholders for gas particles a different mass, suddenly you've opened yourself up to the same thing. And your simulation will transfer energy unphysically from the dark matter to the baryons. So when we're making conclusions about dwarf galaxies from simulations, you do have to worry about these things. I'm not sure it's been fully appreciated that when you do use different masses because you'd like to resolve the baryons more than you'd like to resolve the dark matter, you open yourself up to this risk. For this argument, all I need you to accept is that these dwarf galaxies exist with the stars that we see, and that they are utterly dominated by dark matter. So the utter domination by dark matter relies on the dynamics of the galaxy, and usually making some assumption that it's in some kind of dynamical equilibrium, that it's derealized. So you can dispute that in some cases. In other cases, I think it's more okay. Sure. So in this implicit equation, as time goes on, you will eventually reach a point where the size of the cluster, which I parameterize here by a half-light radius, goes like r to the 1/2. And so any size that you observe today would be transient, because if the dark matter is all machos, then this heating will continue until the characteristic size of the stars is bigger than that of the dark matter halo. That's certainly not the case as we observe them. We see evidence of dark matter halos out to hundreds of parsecs, and that's exactly what you get from cold dark matter. So just how transient would determine what you interpret to be your constraints on dark matter. If all the machos are in 30 solar mass dark matter, then if this galaxy formed 10 or 12 gigayears ago, even if it started out very small, it should puff up so much by now that it would be very strange to see such a small galaxy, physically small galaxy. And so, based on arguments like this, 10 solar mass dark matter, as in all of the dark matter is in black holes of 10 plus solar masses, doesn't seem to work very well. So that is one galaxy, segue one. And anytime you have a conclusion based on one system, it's a little funny. Well, perhaps non-trustworthy, because you can always appeal to something weird once. However, we have around a dozen of these ultra-faint dwarfs now. And in this particular example, it's a little hard to see, but there is a tiny little star cluster that appears to be in the center of this dwarf galaxy. Don't worry if you can't see the dwarf galaxy in here very well. I can't either. So if you have a cluster like this, then the characteristic thing that happens is that the size expands slowly until the point where the mass distribution is dominated by dark matter. Once that happens, once the enclosed mass is dominated by dark matter, then it grows as the square root of t. So in this case, the age is uncertain, although that has been refined recently. The other properties have been measured. And so based on this cluster, this one system, then again, it seems like for any dark matter mass greater than about 10 solar masses, the observed size is extremely transient, and it's hard to imagine a population of them. Yes?
So, are you troubled by the fact that when you do these calculations,
yes,
the calculation that you're specifically doing, which is what you said at the end of your last slide, is that you're attributing all of the mass to these, you know, all of the dark matter has to be in these things.
Yes.
So the way, you know, to turn it around, I mean, another interesting question to ask is, what is the limit on the fraction of the dark matter? Okay.
Yes. So if you reduce the fraction of the dark matter, then you delay that point at which dark matter dominates the mass, and it shows this root T behavior. So at that point, you can argue, depending on your assumptions, that maybe you can accommodate most of the dark matter in these masses. Different groups have done different calculations. I think there is broad agreement that this mass window is basically closed. I think that there are still some people who would argue that there's a tiny bit open here. I'm not sure.
Well, but there's like 50%, yeah, right? I mean, like, there's...
Oh, I meant all of it. Sure, half of it could be in these things. Absolutely. Absolutely. Half of it could be in this dark matter. Other people have suggested that, well, maybe I can just draw a distribution underneath here and squeeze that in. I don't think that's true, because this argument, dynamical heating, for example, if you make a distribution of mass, that's just going to be as effective at heating as a single mass. So you gain nothing by making it into a broad distribution of masses from the dynamical heating argument. From the microlensing argument, likewise. These are counting lenses. The time scale is different here, but basically there just weren't enough brightening events to account for all the dark matter in the halo of the galaxy. These might be a little bit fuzzy because the halo of the Milky Way is something whose mass we don't know precisely. So this, again, might have a little bit of wiggle room.
But I guess
it will be refined by LSST. Yes.
I guess the question that I'm asking is, if we imagine a universe that has multiple different dark matter components that,
yes,
are all interacting in,
yes,
different ways, right?
Yes.
From the perspective of the people who are doing the primordial black hole calculations and who just love them for what they are,
yes,
even if they're 10% of the dark matter,
yes,
or 1% of the dark matter, where are those calculations coming in terms of producing, you know, are they thinking about it as, it's okay to be 50% of the dark matter, like, and not 100%, there could be just very interesting physics associated with,
yes,
that. And where are those, you know, coming from that perspective, where are those models coming in? Like, are they coming in anywhere, or are they caring about this at all, or is it all or nothing from their perspective? Like, if we just take it...
So I think that from this perspective, having 20% of the dark matter be in 10 solar mass black holes is totally fine. Then it's a question for you guys, the theorists, whether there is a natural theory to do that, or whether you're just contriving to stash a little bit of the dark matter here, just under all the observational constraints. So to riff on the old People complain about a god of the gaps. Well, we don't want a dark matter of the gaps, right?
We don't get to order up the universe. It is just what it is. So I guess my question is, and this, you know, if you're headed into discussion, then I'll just shut up for a little bit. But I think this is an interesting, point of like where when you're, you know, when you're looking at primordial black hole models, you know, where do they naturally come in terms of, you know, if you look at, you know, where they're super rare fluctuations or whatever, where do they naturally come in terms of?
I don't think they naturally.
Right, you were talking about this yesterday.
I don't think they naturally come in anywhere on a linear scale.
They're fine-tuned, right?
Yeah.
They're
so
highly fine-tuned to produce only one.
So in the real theory model building, there's no reason why they sit at the abundance sits at one rather than at 0.1 or 100. As far as I'm aware.
Yeah, I mean, I was essentially going to make the same comment that my biggest concern from the like the you know the top-down theory is that there isn't really you're basically tuning how many primordial black holes you want to produce based on. What you think you need to make, isn't really an a priori.
I think the argument that it's one is rather, if you don't believe any other dark matter model,
Right, which is a personal. I think it's a personal preference.
So it comes in from that constraint, saying, I don't believe there's anything other than the standard model, say. Dark matter, the only thing then doesn't,
Okay, so they're all completely fine-tuned and not, there's nothing that you would naturally say, well, we actually really prefer these to come from these, you know, this type of fluctuation or this type, you know, so nothing that would, so that's really depressing.
I mean, I guess maybe the one way I would hedge the comment that I just made. Is that I know there's some people who are thinking about, you know, if you look at, like, multi-field, like, non-minimally coupled multi-field inflation, does this, like, naturally kind of preferentially give you one distribution? So that's one argument, is, like, picking very specific inflationary models and then asking yourself, does this give me a preferential distribution? But then you're still kind of, you know, until we have something that tells us, like, this is a nice model of inflation, you can think of that as moving the fine-tuning to an inflation problem rather than a producing primordial black holes problem. So that's another way of thinking about it. If it makes you, I don't know, it might make you not feel better.
If you wanted to argue in favor of maybe solar mass black holes, you could recognize that the Hubble mass at the QCD phase transition in the early universe was around the Hubble mass. That doesn't mean that you're making black holes there, but it's a coincidence at least that you could leverage.
That's something.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe inflation isn't particularly well suited to producing the right number of primordial black holes. I don't see any reason why.
I just think this whole concept of the right number is not right. Like, there's a number there's a number that you get from the dynamics.
I mean, the mass fraction at the time, in the radiation area, something like 10 to the minus 20 is the number you're aiming for. Right. So, it's a bit like producing a cosmological constant that's such a tiny level that we observe. You wouldn't perhaps do it. So it's only if you believe you've got to get there that you might be prepared to tune it.
Yeah.
And also, to be fair, below the mu distortion, the CMB distortion scale, we don't know much about the history of inflation. So nothing prohibits to nothing.
Yeah.
Coming back to this work here,
sure.
I wonder, so everything is sort of also a question of time scales, right? Because you have an energy exchange between two reservoirs, if you want, in the PDA, the PDH and stars.
Yes.
So is it clear that you start up with the right initial conditions? So you have a transient phenomena, right? I wonder how out of equilibrium the things are initially and then...
Well, equilibrium would consist of the stars being puffier than the dark matter halo. So we know, as we look at these things today, they are not in a dynamical equilibrium. If the dark matter is in low mass things, then they should cool the stars. The dynamical equilibrium is for the stars to go like that. So one way or another, their current configurations are most certainly transient. It's just that for dynamical cooling, the time scale for them to cool is much, much longer than the Hubble time. For some of these models, the time scale for them to heat is not much longer than a Hubble time. And so that's where this argument comes from. So I started these clusters anywhere from kind of something like their current size or from the size of star clusters that we observe forming today, which are considerably smaller than these dwarf galaxies. In that case, you could interpret the sizes that we see as you started from something small, you're dynamically heating, and we happen to observe all of them at some characteristic size today. If you wanted to explain everything from that perspective, then I suppose you could say, well, half the dark matter is in 10 solar mass black holes, and that kind of sort of does it. I think that's in tension with other probes, but you could make that sort of an argument, I suppose. Or you could view that half of it's in 10 solar mass black holes as an upper limit, and we just don't understand star formation and dwarf galaxies well enough, which I think is certainly a true statement. Yeah?
So I was kind of curious about the uncertainty in the aging of the cluster.
Yes.
So that's
three. There has been work since this.
Okay.
So this is from the paper from a couple years ago. There's been a series of observations of the cluster since then that put the age in between these two numbers, closer to the old age, but it might not be, a galaxy might not all be coeval. The stars might not have formed all at the same time. There was cool evidence of at least one star in the cluster that is intermediate in age, a few billion years. Yes?
So I guess I was wondering about how to evade some of these limits, and I've been thinking about machos, but from a more phenomenological point of view,
sure,
where I'm treating both the mass and their size as free parameters. So
okay.
I guess here what you're thinking is point-like primordial black holes, but if I can fluff out the dark matter, what length scale do you expect the limits to weaken for 100% of the dark matter being, say, 10
so
or 100 solar mass?
This dynamical heating is dominated by two-body relaxation, which in turn is dominated by weak scatterings. Weak scatterings meaning, let's say, 10 parsecs or something, to throw out a vague number. So I would expect that if the dark matter is significantly smaller than a few parsecs, then these limits should hold. Once you make it bigger than that, then I would expect these limits to weaken. Some scale like that. Yeah? You have a question?
Yeah, I just want to make a comment that there have been work on primordial black hole that's not formed during the inflation. It can
yes
come from like some scatter field evolution of inflation or from, for instance, the collapse of the axion coming wall network. Yeah, so it's not directly tied to inflation, it could come from other sources.
But I guess I'm still, I mean, so if you're always tuning it, because you don't believe any of the other dark matter models, so if you're always tuning it to 100%, that seems to, like, deny the richness of the theory or something, and then actually there might be just a natural number that comes out. Maybe it's 1%. Like, if I see a black hole of 10 solar masses, I still want to know if it's a primordial black hole or if it's from some stellar evolution.
Yeah.
And so that's an interesting question in of itself, and so I just want to... Maybe.
To me, 100% is more like anthropic, it is more than to me, like less than 100% sounds more unnatural. Why it has to be there?
Right, but it's not sounding like you do your calculation, you're like, huh, like we have this distribution of primordial black holes from either the scalar field evolution or from inflation, and that's what it looks like. I know it's not all the dark matter, but it's all the 10 solar mass black holes in the universe or something like that. And to me, that's, you're looking like very disturbed by what I just said, so please share.
You have some model parameters you can change model parameters, you can always upgrade them, it's not that everything's fixed, so that will change the prediction for population. So I'm not sure. Maybe some magic model.
So does this give you, when you actually have to, you know, so you've been able to tune into 100% and that's ruled out, and so now you got, you know, 50%. So what does that, how does that constrain the other model parameters in an interesting way, or no? Not really.
Yeah, I think most have some constraint on the model parameters,
but
it cannot be more than 100%, but below that, I'm not sure.
No, it cannot be more than 50%. Yeah. So your life just got easier in some ways.
Well, I'm going to suggest in a couple slides that the limits are actually, might be more serious than that from microlensing. But to me, looking at this kind of, talking on my rear end at some point here because I don't work on this area, it seemed to me that the primordial black holes, like you were saying, it was just a way of evading any kind of addition to the standard model. And if you can't fit 100% of the dark matter in primordial black holes, then do you have any particular reason to try at all? Is there some rich aspect of the theory that, I think I'm probably just restating your discussion and Juna's questions. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, they're interested, you know, when people are fascinated, you know, it could happen, right? And they'd be,
oh, yeah.
Like, this mass, they're stable, they hang around, and they have effects, you might,
oh, yeah.
You might see them.
That's right. Oh, yeah.
So,
okay, so there are a few caveats for Eridani 2 that I think have been mitigated by subsequent work. The cluster really does look like it's at the galaxy center. Also, if you really wanted to, you could imagine that this star cluster has a much larger velocity dispersion and is actually dominated by some intermediate mass black hole at its center. I don't think that's the case. We haven't found evidence of intermediate mass black holes generically in all these dwarf galaxies, and it's not for lack of looking. And there are 10 other compact ultra-faint dwarfs. So you can appeal to all manner of odd scenarios for one system, but if we have around a dozen of them, then I think that gets harder to imagine. At higher masses for the black holes, you run into these dynamical problems only become worse because the transfer of energy in bulk tends to go towards the low mass things. You can think of this as kind of like a dynamical friction or an analog to that, sort of. Yeah.
Has anyone redone the wide binaries with Gaia?
I don't know.
That comes from this Chaname and Gould, from an old proper motion catalog. And
yes.
Now, like, that just seems like such low-hanging, juicy fruit.
I think Will Sutherland maybe looked at this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yeah, I think
so that probably should be updated.
Yeah,
that's an old,
yeah.
That's an old thing.
Yeah.
That was pre-Gaia.
Yeah.
What's the right way to exclude the intermediate mass black holes? What's the best way to exclude it? Because that's something that's always invoked by people that talk about primordial black holes, and that's the one thing.
Oh, yes. Well, people are looking at the center of these dwarf galaxies dynamically. If they really have big black holes in them, then you should see an increase in velocity dispersion towards the center as these things get more and more bound. And in some cases, you might hope to see some measure of accretion as this thing is eating some amount of gas. I don't know all of my limits. I know there are limits on the mass of any possible intermediate mass black holes in many galaxy clusters, or many dwarf galaxies, but I do not have the numbers. I would have to look them up. And if you have a small fraction of the dark matter being these seeds for the supermassive black holes we see today, none of this has anything to say about that. Yeah?
Coming back to the 100% question.
Yes.
So there's been some work by Marty Rydell and his group where they basically study the region if you have this sort of mass black holes at 100%, and they argue by running n-body simulations that in the early universe, the way how the systems dynamically evolve,
okay,
you basically change the initial conditions such that the merger rate is quenched later on. And so by that, that allows you to get away with LIGO constraints.
So So, you have 100% of it in one solar mass black holes early on.
Early on,
and then there's a set of mergers early on, and so you end up with 100% of the dark matter in primordial mass black holes today, but...
It's not necessarily the mergers. I think it just changes probably the velocity somehow, or the initial conditions such that the merger rate and the low-redshift universe is quenched somehow.
Sure.
The microlensing. At one solar mass, if you go back to your plot, I think that's where the microlensing
is. It doesn't matter if it's 10 solar mass, whatever. So I just wonder about that. Your constraint is sort of independent of that issue, right? Because you're already in mass system, so you basically completely evade that.
Yes, we just care about some average mass of the black holes. And all of the constraints, aside from LIGO, basically just, if it's 100% black holes, they just care about the fraction of dark matter that's in black holes and the characteristic mass of those black holes, some weighted average, where the weighting on that average depends upon the technique. So dynamical heating is going to be one weighting, microlensing is going to be a different weighting. There's been other more thorough work since I made this suggestion a few years ago. So it has refined the picture, in some cases weakened the constraints slightly. In this case, more detailed simulations showed that t to the 0.4 is probably a better approximation than the naive analytic t to the 0.5. That changes the answer by a little bit. On the other hand, the number of dwarfs has grown, and so from that perspective, these constraints are, I think, more robust to claims that we've just gotten lucky in a few cases.
What is the physics for the first one, for the change in the scale? But what do they do?
They do a full Fokker-Planck approximation. So I just did a diffusion approximation. I don't have an intuition for why 0.4. I mean, the diffusion approximation, I would think, would be reasonably good. And I think it is reasonably good, as in Fokker-Planck approximations get almost the same answer, which, considering the level of approximation, seems fair to me.
But they still make that diffusion approximation for all the scales.
Yes. That's right. They're still making a diffusion approximation. I did multiple sets of averaging that they're not doing. They're just following the different populations of bodies and exchanging energy between them. They're doing the full phase space calculation. There were some integrals over phase space that I approximated. Okay, so I think the bottom line conclusion here is that these massive black holes are hard to reconcile, maybe not impossible, it's very hard to reconcile with being all the dark matter from these dynamical arguments. And so I wanted to briefly touch on some of these other points about which I know less. Some of you might know more. And maybe this sparks a little bit of discussion. I still don't know why. I guess I have an idea of maybe why microlensing hasn't gotten the attention it perhaps deserves. But I think it should get a little bit more attention.
Well, it'll get a lot more attention with the new experiments, I think, because I think it'll, I think all those constraints were done from people looking for this back in the Matra days, also Eros. Those communities transferred a lot to looking for planets.
Yes.
So they sort of abandoned the, they were like, we ruled out the dark matter, it's not the Matras we care about, let's look for planets. And so there was no one really there to beat the drums. And I do think that the next, like KMTNet and WFIRST may, and LSST maybe, may invigorate that more. But I don't think, the people who cared about making the dark matter matches, once it wasn't the answer they wanted, they started doing interesting stuff like planets or whatever, and they abandoned the...
Yes. I'm also not... About that window, there are constraints on higher mass windows for microlensing of multiply imaged quasars. That's a topic that I think has largely been... So everybody shows these macho constraints, even though they're from a long time ago, and people, maybe don't pay as much attention now, but it's these statistical brightness variations in multiple image quasars. I don't think this has been appreciated, so I'll discuss that in just a minute. Okay, for the CMB and for distortions from the CMB, I think this is the latest and greatest, most thorough work from Yassine. And depending on exactly what you assume about how the regions around these black holes get ionized, you can most certainly rule out 100 solar masses plus being all of the dark matter. Although, I think there were claims that this window was more thoroughly ruled out before, and this update maybe gives you a little bit of weasel room around here. So I think you could make an argument that maybe it's not totally shut here. But I want to spend a little bit of time discussing this last point, which is that if you have multiple images of a single strongly lensed quasar, you've probably seen some of these beautiful pictures where you have a galaxy cluster and then you have four images of a quasar around it. Those four images of a quasar are not the same brightness. And the distribution of brightness is due both from the macro lensing, from a smooth distribution of matter, and from micro lensing, where you have an individual star even at just the right point to perturb that lensing map just a little bit. And so depending on whether the dark matter is in big or small things, then that perturbation can be a little bit different. There is a scale invariance here in that if you have a single distribution of masses or a single mass, then the distribution of magnifications should be independent of that mass. But for reasons I don't fully understand, if you have a background, a lensing mass distribution that's composed of both bigger things and smaller things, that symmetry is broken, and you can actually get a more complicated distribution of magnifications between the different images. So this is from a paper by Paul Schechter, in which he was correcting an earlier claim that you should be totally insensitive to the distribution of masses in the galaxy or in the intervening dark matter halo. So what he showed by numerical calculations was that if everything's at one mass, you get one distribution of relative magnifications statistically, and if everything is separated into two different mass distributions, one more massive, one less massive, then this distribution looks different, and this is something you can test.
How many, like, do you need a quad lens, or can you use a triple, and how many, like, is that, I mean, I would assume that a lot of the reason why this didn't get that much attention is that there just haven't been too many, but now there are kind of like 100 or so quad lenses.
That might be enough. So this is based on a couple tens of quasars. So the most recent update to this, applying it to dark matter, was from a group that said, well, we have these data in this analysis in 2015, scaling it to primordial black hole dark matter is pretty easy, let's just do it. And so they did. But I think a more thorough treatment of this is warranted. So here's that more recent, I think the only paper that's really applied this to primordial black hole dark matter. And it doesn't have that many citations. So what they're doing here is they're using quasars both in the optical and in the X-ray, and they're taking advantage not just of this distribution, but from the finite size of these sources. The optically emitting region in the quasar is cooler and extends further than the X-ray emitting region, which is hotter and is located closer to the supermassive black hole. So, in one case, they infer that a modest fraction of these halos is in, let's say, 0.1 or 0.2 solar mass objects, presumably stars. In X-rays, where the emitting region is significantly smaller, they lose that constraint on what size they are, but they get a consistent mass fraction of a couple tenths. So put these together, and they don't put a statistical significance in any of this, but it certainly looks like a smooth distribution plus of dark matter plus stars of order this mass reproduces what you see. It doesn't look like a significant fraction of the dark matter is at much higher masses. So based on all of these things, I think putting all of the dark matter in this particular mass window of primordial black holes is pretty problematic. I do think that the asteroid window remains pretty open. I'm not sure. So there have been some claims of constraints in that window. I'm not sure how robust those are. But I think that if it's not completely closed, then this mass window of something like 10 solar masses is pretty well closed. And I think there is a significant opportunity, if somebody is keen, to do a little bit more work in the microlensing. This is a tiny, tiny community that knows how to do this and works on it, basically founded by Paul Schechter and with a few other people around the world. So maybe if Paul Schechter is interested, then he could do a thorough treatment of that.
I guess I've been kind of wondering, you know, from a different context, I've been kind of thinking about how do we address the issue of like these small masses and wanting to do simulations. Because we have this limit that you were just talking about, like maybe 20 minutes ago, with like how big your particle size is going to be in simulations.
Yeah.
So is this the sort of thing where you just look at data and you don't try and make comparisons with expectations, or kind of, so what direction are people thinking in with that?
From a standpoint of cosmological simulations?
Okay.
So cosmological simulations use softening because they basically have to suppress the strong scatterings. If you have those strong scatterings, then the time steps that they can take become intolerable, and the codes just grind to a halt. So that means they are suppressing two-body relaxation. They're suppressing some of these dynamical problems, and people have worried about the subtle dynamical things that these cold dark matter simulations get wrong. So I think those simulations are very, very far from being able to address anything like this, and are still at the point where I don't think it's totally certain that they're getting all of the big picture things right on their end at the masses they're using.
Well, it's always, I mean, in defense of cosmological simulations, I don't know why I feel compelled to defend them. You know, I think it's always a question of the problem you're trying to answer. So
yes.
In this case, that machinery is neither tuned for nor adequate for comparison. So that's why the Fokker-Planck simulation types of calculations and the simple, and the nice thing about this is that Tim can sit in his office late at night and, you know, write down some stuff and get a really nice constraint. So it's actually a great argument in favor of like sometimes just using your pencil. But I would say that you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like the simulations are getting at things like the subhalo mass function that you cannot get with these types of calculations. And that's where if you want to look at lensing and, you know, weak lensing and all those types of things, right, those simulations are very powerful. Now, if they are making mistakes at this scale, then that becomes a real challenge in interpreting those data.
Yes.
But for this particular problem, really, instead of needing precision sort of cosmology on grand scales, what you need is precision on really small scales. You need really good radial velocities, really good proper motions, really good whatever, you know, to get the dynamics of a few hundred stars in a few systems, as opposed to, a few hundred million galaxies. Right.
I guess I didn't mean like to be negative about it. I guess I'm thinking about it more as kind of like a matching problem.
Yeah.
Of like kind of where the state of the art is, or kind of where people are thinking about doing that kind of matching. Partly because, and I think, again, this is not to knock the significance of embodied simulations and what they contribute, right? Is that often we kind of, there's a feedback loop of what we think we know about how these systems are working based on what we're being told from the simulations. And so I guess partly what I was kind of trying to muddle through in my mind is, how do I know what is what, and where there are assumptions lurking that aren't being explicitly articulated, for example. I think that was more kind of, I have embodied simulation friends.
And people certainly do use embodied simulations to study these kinds of dynamical relaxation processes and clusters. That has long been its own separate field. It's a different world where you're trying to run things, you're trying to capture different sets of interactions, and you have, let's say, 100,000 or 1,000,000 particles and not a big cosmological simulation. So very, very different. Groups of people coming at it from very different perspectives.
I just want to say, you know, simulations don't kill physics. People kill physics. but I think, as a general rule of thumb, like whenever you're probing something at small scale and at the biggest scales of the boxes, you know, there would be dragons always, right?
Yes.
And I think this is a question that sits squarely in that type of the regime.
Yes. And I think for the cosmological simulations, they're pushing to a point where they can start to address these dwarf galaxies now. So these issues that were kind of irrelevant earlier, where they didn't trust those things anyway, now they're starting to dig through all these things, decide whether they can trust them. And this is, I think, a frontier in seeing whether lambda CDM really works at these small scales, both in improving the data and in making sure that we trust the simulations.
So a place where the microlensing, the quasar microlensing, has been kind of a cottage industry has been in the H-naught, trying to get at the Hubble parameter by measuring time delay differences. Mm-hmm. And is that the same? Does that same data set lend itself to this constraint? So in that paper that you referenced,
They didn't specifically mention that, though I would expect so. And I say this as somebody who knows very little about this field. But I suspect so. I think there's been very little drive and enthusiasm from that field to address this problem. But if they set their minds to it, I think they could do a thorough job in relatively short order. Yeah.
But I think you touched on this in the talk, but maybe I missed the point. So I guess now there are dozens of dwarfs discovered.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying Eridanus is optimal for getting limits from dynamical heating in some sense?
The best limits on dynamical heating come from the galaxies, the dwarf galaxies that are old, with low velocity dispersions, and that are dominated by dark matter, and that are small. So that's four boxes to check. Mm-hmm. And so the cluster in Eridanus II does a very good job of checking those boxes. There are several other galaxies that do almost as well at checking all of those boxes. So I started out working up thinking how this applies to Eridanus II's cluster. But now I think the argument doesn't rely on that so much. And there are a series of clusters that all are currently maybe 20, 30 parsecs or something in size. Pretty clearly dominated by dark matter, pretty clearly very old and appear to have low velocity dispersions.
So you'd expect a comparable limit from one of those clusters? Or
yes.
Put together, I suppose, the limit, if one were to do some kind of joint analysis of all of these clusters in there, or all of these dwarfs in their clusters.
It's not like the limit from all of them together would be stronger than the limit for one individually. In that case, you would be hypothesizing basically all these things started out small. They were all being heated by machos, and that's why they're all 20 or 30 parsecs today. Okay? So that would give you for example, half of the dark matter is in 10 solar mass launchers. I think that is a bit of fine-tuning unwarranted and disfavored by other arguments, but I think that's equivalent to a statement of the limit here. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
So these are strongly lensed quasars. The brightness variation, is that a static brightness variation of the various lensed images, or is this a time-dependent?
Time-dependent, but given the distances involved, the time dependence would be fairly slow, and you just have snapshots of this. In the case of a star,
they were good members of the information. I mean, they take a lot of these measurements.
Yes.
The microlensing is how the extrinsic variability is actually large. I mean, it's of order the intrinsic variability that they're using to constrain. If you do that,
okay.
I've been playing with it. It's actually a large effect. It's not usually mentioned much in the talks because.
Okay.
Not going with the narrative, but it's quite large.
All right, I stand corrected. So maybe, that particular paper that I mentioned was just using snapshots, but I think that they probably could do more with this.
The Cosmo Grail data is quite good for
if you wanted to do something like this. All right. Seems like a good thing for somebody to do. Somebody wants to put the bug in someone's ear. All I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Tim.
Sorry. Sorry.
More questions?
If I might go to ask, so what determines the baryon fraction and dark matter fraction in the form? Is that the formation process difference or?
And these why the ultrafaint dwarfs? Okay, so the ultrafaint dwarfs have baryon fractions that are very, very low, 10 to the minus 3 or something, even lower potentially. I think to some degree it's an open problem exactly why that is, why some dark matter halos form a few stars, why some form none. So dark matter halos, as you go up in mass, they become more efficient at forming stars, and then they become less efficient as you get to various very high masses. This is a classic result from decades ago, but really understanding why this happens has been a field it's a big field with a lot of people and a lot of papers. Understanding exactly what regulates star formation in these dwarf galaxies, how and why they lose their gas, whether their potential wells aren't big enough, they can't hold on to it and form stars at all, whether the first supernova just blow out the gas and that's it, whether there are multiple episodes of star formation. This is a very active field. Not mine at all.
How small the baryon to dark matter ratio has to be for you to ignore the baryon effect?
To ignore the
-2 or -3?
To ignore the baryon effect in the argument that I presented?
Yeah.
So I was not looking. So the baryons themselves will have some relaxation between one another, but I was looking at just a net transfer of energy from the reservoir of the primordial black holes to the stars. So it doesn't matter what the mass fraction is in baryons, that transfer will still happen. If the mass distribution is dominated by the black holes, then there'll be some energy injection. If the mass distribution is dominated by the baryons, then they will grow more slowly because the baryons provide most of the potential themselves. So here, that's this transition from where the baryons dominate the mass to where the dark matter dominates the mass density. And so you have two different behaviors here from these two terms. This is the mass in stars, the potential provided by that, and then this is the mass in, this is from the dark matter.
So you're saying the beta component does not
reflect in the what determines how fast a thing puffs up, if you have a set of black holes in the background, they will inject energy into the baryons, but how quickly that makes the baryons puff up depends upon how far out of the potential well the baryons need to climb. If the baryons are providing their own potential, then in the limit that it's all baryons, yes, you'll be injecting energy, but it will puff up very, very slowly, because this rate of energy injection will be small compared with the energy you need to puff up the cluster.
Any more questions? I think that's thanked him again.